Welcome to Obesity, a Disease, the official Obesity Medicine Association podcast exploring the many facets of the disease of obesity. Obesity, a Disease podcast is brought to you by the Obesity Medicine Association, the clinical leader in obesity medicine.
Hi, this is the next edition of Obesity as a Disease. And here today, we're going to talk about the latest edition of the pediatric algorithm, which is coming out in the next few weeks. I have here with me Dr. Val O'Hara and Dr. Rui Carofa to talk with me about this edition of the pediatric algorithm. And I'm going to be your host for this podcast. I'm Dr. Suzanne Kuda. I'm a pediatric obesity specialist. I'm a master fellow of the OMA, a fellow of the American Academy of Pediatrics. And I'm the executive editor for Obesity Pillars. And I have been practicing obesity medicine in San Antonio, Texas for about, 10, 12 years now. And I have my own private practice, which I run. So now I'm going to move on to having Dr. Carofa introduce herself.
Thanks so much for having me. So I'm Rui Carofa. I work at the Center for Better Health and Nutrition at Cincinnati Children's Hospital, where I serve as the associate director of our weight management program for children. I've been there for 10 years now, board certified in obesity medicine, and feel very fortunate to be able to work in this field with so many amazing people like Dr. Kuda.
And Val?
I'm Val O'Hara. I'm a pediatrician and obesity specialist. I'm the former director of two pediatric management clinics that I started here in Maine in 2009 and currently work at the Maine Weight Management Center at Maine Health in the southern part of the state. I'm also a member of the OMA Pediatric Board and serve with Suzanne as a reviewer for Obesity Pillars, which has been super exciting and excited to talk with all of you today.
Okay, so today we're talking about the latest edition of the pediatric algorithm. This is a 2025 edition. And in this edition, we've made some additions, some new topics that we're going to go over today. But I think it's been kind of an exciting year, last 2 years for pediatric obesity. We are 2 years out from the approval of semaglutide in the use of teens. And I think the response to that in terms of treatment for teenagers has been overall a very positive experience for those kids who are able to get the medication. And for those of us who have been able to provide that care, it's certainly been kind of a breakthrough in treatment for these children. And then we're 2 years also since the AAP clinical practice guidelines. So in which, we had a big change in the approach to treating children. And I think that we're at a point now where we can ask, how are we doing on that? So maybe we'll get a chance to talk about that today. We have more use of anti-obesity medication now in children over the last 2 years. Even down, we've got some new publications where we've in clinical trials been using it in children less than 12, which is kind of very exciting, and approval for setmelanotide down to the age of 2. So I think in the pharmacology realm, there's some great things going on too. And then I think there's been a growing sense of importance of weight stigma and bias in our population that is making a difference in how we approach these kids. And the practice community, I think, for pediatric obesity is getting stronger and stronger. Academically, professionally, and just the camaraderie between the providers who do this nationwide and really internationally as well. We have some international partners who are fantastic. So I think we've got a lot to look forward to. Now with that, I'm going to move on to the algorithm. So the first thing we wanted to touch on was the addition of a section on pathophysiology. So Rui, can you talk to us about what we did new?
Yeah, so we've always been good at recognizing the epigenetics, right, and how that affects our patient population. But something we dove in deeper this year is really the plasticity part of it and that neuroplasticity, which is so important and I think sometimes under-recognized. That ability to program both positive and negative behaviors. Some of those behaviors, right, are rooted in epigenetics, but some of them really come after. And that relates both to the common question of the fat set point and also just the behaviors that then come before or after establishing that fat set point. And so I think it's really important that we as a medical community understand this plasticity and how it's forming from very early when we are giving food as rewards and how that is affecting the fat set point to how that continues on throughout early childhood. And then we have a fat set point that can we really change, right? So we talk about in adults so much about the fat set point, but we don't really know exactly in kids when that is going to be solidified and when it's too late. And so this discussion leads us back to when is the right time to intervene, and the right time is the earliest time that we can.
Yeah, I think that is such an important point and such a difference between adult medicine and practice of obesity medicine in children. So, I mean, that plasticity, we can make big changes if we just get to them early and really change the course of the disease. What do you think about that, Val?
I 100% agree, and I think that reinforces exactly one of the main points of the AAP-CPG that came out is when you see it, treat it. Early intervention with the most intensive intervention with whatever you have at your disposal. If you're in an academic center and you have an entire team, or if you're a primary care doc trying to do it, reach out to your colleagues, your obesity specialists who can help. I think that's really important. The other piece that I really love that we added to the algorithm included sort of a graphic looking at and explaining the cognitive brain, the metabolic brain, and the reward brain, and understanding that there is biology to this pathology. I think when I pull that slide up for my families, it's an aha moment. It's a way to decrease bias and shame because we're describing the biology and the dysregulation like any other disease. And if we can get a patient and a family to let that go, and we can take that from them and then start to have those conversations about why this might be much more difficult for you versus someone else. And that's what our goal is, to really help them understand and move forward in that regard to an openness to engage in those therapies.
I think one of the things that we see a lot that is kind of a red flag is when we see a young child who is whose height age is going off the curve. I mean, obviously they refer to us because their weight is going up, but really we see the height age going up too. When we don't see that, of course, we think endocrine problem, right? But in our case, our specialty, it's more common that the growth and the bone age are going skyrocketing up. So, what do y'all think about that? I think that that is a real sign that I look for when I see growth charts.
Yes, I agree. I think you can reassure it because oftentimes when patients are coming to you, they think, oh, I must have an endocrine or a gland problem. And we can show them that your child is growing vertically well or excessively, right? And so understanding that does help, again, just get away from those myths and misconceptions that sometimes might not lead us down the right path and help our families understand what we're trying to work on together for sure.
And also a warning sign to the family that your child isn't just large for age. This is part of the disease process and can lead to early pubertal development and, eventual problems perhaps with adult height if the growth plates fuse early. And once you start pointing these things out, I think they really do get more, you get more buy-in from the family.
And I love
Okay.
that you brought up the growth charts because one more thing about this section that was new is really talking more about the adiposity rebound and the fact that we should really be paying attention to those kids who are having earlier rebound. I think in the past, really, people weren't referring or weren't intervening because the rebound was not above the 95th percentile, but they weren't taking into account that you might have gone from 5 to 85 in a very short period of time. And so let's not wait till we're at 97 or class three obesity, right? We're already seeing the trend right there. So leading us back to earlier is better.
Yeah. And that, we really see that in that 2 to 7 year old age range when we start to see that adiposity rebound just go right off that chart. So, yeah, again, we're circling around how important it is to get to these kids as early as possible, which leads me into our next topic, which is treating the young child, which was another thing we added to the algorithm. So, Bao, you
Yeah.
want to start that conversation?
I think it's really important. I think we forget that when we talk with sometimes with our adult colleagues, how often we see early onset obesity and in the young child, and what sort of tools do we have? And
Let's
I think
define the young child right off the bat.
so anyone under 12, right? So if we want to say adolescents, we might say even younger, but I think our and we also refer within the algorithm to our CPS that really focused. So greater detail is in that CPS, and we do highlight it in the algorithm. But I think there's, a disconnect sometimes for even clinicians who are not accustomed to taking care of children to say, oh, well, they're young, they're going to grow into their weight or what have you. We understand that there's significant disease early on. And to what Dr. Karofi was saying, we want to intervene early as much as we can. And so when you start to see those trends, whether it's growth or what have you, we need to look at that. And then the other challenge has been, well, if we find it and we have an 8-year-old, what sort of tools do we have? And to your point, Suzanne, early on, for example, some of the medications are finally being studied in that age range. And we have that Scale Kids paper that just came out to really look at that. But it also, we need to think about precocious puberty. There's a great section on that that we've included, and sort of looking at the whole picture. And then we also have to step back and think about the mental health and what these children are experiencing in their school life, in their home life, when they are carrying a diagnosis of obesity.
And really, what do you have anything to add to that?
I absolutely agree with everything you're saying. And then just bringing that plasticity back in for that young child again, right? How do we really, we need to have a care plan, right? That touches on everything. And so in the society we live, how do we get healthy guidelines from the beginning in terms of screen time, healthy functions with limits on them? And how do we do systems of rewards in families that don't revolve around food?
Right. And I think that when we discuss the child under 12 and trying to get past all the societal and let's face it, medical biases against even managing these kids for the disease of obesity, that we have to remind ourselves and our families and our colleagues really that the disease, this is a disease. And we're treating the disease. We're not treating the age of the child. This is just the disease presenting at that age. And not to confuse the age of the child or let the age of the child determine the treatment. The disease determines the treatment. And I think
We would
that
never not treat
something.
someone who had another disease because they weren't old enough.
Right. I
And
mean, why
so,
would you not manage a child with another, we manage asthma, hypertension, diabetes in kids of all ages, but suddenly we can't do it until they're a teenager now. That's,
it's
And I think,
interesting. The most chronic diseases, when you're younger, we are more concerned. If a 2-year-old has high blood pressure, if a 2-year-old has diabetes. So it's interesting that we view obesity completely differently when we need to view it the same way with the same urgency.
Exactly. Yeah.
Right. And I think when we have intensive lifestyle therapies that we're engaging in, and yet the disease is not improving, that should be what guides your decision to augment your therapy. You wouldn't continue to do something if it wasn't working for a patient with any other diagnosis. And our patients feel that if they're running into a clinician who's not acknowledging that.
Right.
Absolutely. Okay.
And then the next new section to the algorithm that we wanted to talk about was for physical activity. What do you think about that, Dr. Karufa?
So we have a new slide in here that I absolutely love, and I want to blow it up and put it on my wall. And it won't be for all families, but I know some would really just love to see this. And the reason why is because, again, as a society, everyone's trying to simplify it. You just need to be active and eat, right? And we know that there's so much more than that. And this diagram really outlines what happens in the muscle and what hormones are sent out and how that has an effect on BDNF and how that increased activity not only produces muscle hypertrophy, but decreases appetite, right? And that's not something I think we're good about consistently telling our families that everything is linked, right? And I think that's especially important in families with kids with hyperphagia because we have our genetic hyperphagia, but we also have families with kids who have excess hunger because of excess carbs and sleep that's off. And they're so fixated on that one thing because as parents, that's what we do, right? And so to be able to tie the activity to decreased appetite, I think is amazing. It's another way to tell these families we're working in more ways to help control the symptoms that are really interfering in your everyday life.
And it reinforces our pathophysiology and physiology slides, right? And I pulled that slide up, and it was super fun creating that slide. But I think, when I show a kiddo, like, hey, you know what? You're doing great at recess. You're running. You're playing. You're chasing your dog around. This is what's happening. Your muscles are making more irisin, and it's communicating with our fat cells. They have a role to play. They're not all bad, right? Same thing. People say, oh, my fat is bad. My fat is an important organ. And if I can convert my white fat to brown fat or tan fat, that's going to be much more energy and thermogenic for my metabolism. And so when they can kind of wrap their brains around that, that's super exciting. My muscles are making myokines. What are those? I'm making irisin. That's communicating with my brain, like you said, for BDNF. It helps all of those things. And I live in Maine, so I tell them when you're in the winter in Maine, you're making more irisin in the cold than you do in the hot. No offense, Suzanne. So, go out and play in the snow because it's going to really be nice. Because I think sometimes kids think about, oh my gosh, you're asking me about my exercise. I want to know how you're playing because this is why I'm asking. There's physiology here. And I think that tends to resonate. And I pull that slide all the time, and I get a lot of positive feedback from their patients. As well as their parents, because it's not just about I'm trying to burn off my Cinnabon or my whatever. This is really metabolically healthy in so many ways. And those cardiometabolic markers show up that way. And their mood is better.
Yes. So,
Absolutely.
just for those people who cannot see the slides in front of them or have the algo in front of them, maybe listening to this wherever, can we define BDNF?
BDNF is brain-derived neurotrophic factor.
Thank you. Okay. Yes. Because I
And
think we
I,
said that twice at least.
yeah,
So,
I
and we
want to
should
throw it out
make
there.
sure
And
that.
I just wanted to emphasize something you said because it's so important. It takes the negativity out of the word fat cell, right? When families can understand that fat cells can do positive things for our body, because that word has such a negative connotation and it really just shows them how their body can work to help them even more.
Right. And it shows them that they're doing a lot of healthy things, right? They may not see their BMI change as perfect or imperfect as that might be, but they can share that I am playing more. I feel more strength. I am sleeping better, because that ties back in, as you said, Rui. It goes back into all the physiology and the connectedness. So, and when we're explaining this, then we can also start to show within the pathophysiology slide when we are talking about a medication, where is it targeting to help that? And this becomes very much something they can visualize and understand, why we're using some of these medications, why they're more effective than other things, and augments their intensive lifestyle therapy. So I think that hopefully, if those who are going to look into the new updated algorithm will find those slides helpful and useful clinically too to share with their patients.
I think another thing that we added to the algorithm was a discussion of the adolescent athlete with obesity, which was based again on our CPS, in which we discussed this. But I think this is the classic where you have the child who has the accelerated growth as as prepubertal and is in sports. A lot of them are placed in sports, even encouraged to be in sports because they're large for age and they can excel at sports. But suddenly, when they get to be adolescents, they're much at much greater risk for injury, especially for those of our patients that struggle with high temperatures in the summer. And here in South Texas, this is a real issue. Football practice begins in August, and if you have been suffering from obesity and you get out there in the extreme heat, you're very likely to have a heat injury. And so we spend a lot of time discussing this to prevent those kinds of injuries and encouraging year-round conditioning, because certainly weight should not preclude you from being in a sport. And then, of course, I think the other thing that I'm not sure it's really understood at any level that we can approach clinically, but the intrinsic bias towards the children is out there, where the coaches are putting them in certain positions. They're getting relegated to sports that might not be of their choice, but because of their size, they're put into that because the coaches know that they will have a better chance at excelling in those particular types of sports, or events when you're talking about track and field. And I think we need to empower our kids to say,
Autonomy.
I don't want to be throwing the shot put, or I do want to throw the shot put because I know I'm going to kill everybody, when I compete. But it has to be their choice, So I'm
Such an
hoping.
important statement, Suzanne, to really empower our youth and our adolescents. Oftentimes, they've experienced a long-standing bias and stigma. And how do we instill that positivity, regardless of what size I am, and really to have their voice. And I think when they find something that they can excel in, we want to make sure that we're keeping them conditioned so they're not having time out. So again, having a low threshold for utilizing other colleagues, if there's concern about an injury, is there a sports medicine physician you want to work with or a physical therapist to ensure that they're going to be able to participate safely and really reach their goals, because we don't want that to get in the way for them either, for sure.
Okay, let's move on to discussing another section, new section in the algorithm, which is telemedicine.
I love telemedicine, as you well know. I live in a very rural state, and I think, when we think about telemedicine, all of us have experienced COVID. Clearly, we understood the utility and the need for that. I think when we started offering our telemedicine, we offered the entire comprehensive team from our medical part, our dietitian, and our behavioral health, and as well as our athletic trainers remotely for some of our patients who live very rurally. They did very well. We have patients who we were able to successfully teach how to use their injectable medications online. I think we know when we think about access to obesity physicians, there was a great publication a few years ago that looked at where are they. We have expanded, as you started at the very beginning of our conversation, Suzanne, expanding the obesity medicine physicians around. I think the first year was 394 board certified obesity physicians, now over 6,000. So we have grown, including in pediatrics. But there's still a paucity of that for patients who live rurally and other and also in underserved areas. So when we think about the utility of telemedicine, it definitely can increase our reach. It can decrease attrition, no-shows, and if we can see our patients, we can take care of them. So I think that's a really important part of utilizing telemedicine. And I also will say I was able to share in a recent publication that some of our patients who have children with special needs, thinking about our special needs section, sometimes they just do better not having the stress of having to go into an appointment. They can be home. Their BHP workers, their care workers, their case managers can also join. So you can have more of the patient's care team available. So there's a lot of pluses. There are some negatives and risks, obviously, that we want to be cognizant of, but we need to do a better job of utilizing this tool to really get the specialty where those kids are.
Yeah, I think the challenge is, especially in this post-COVID, era now, where how can we effectively use telemedicine, keep the same standards of care that we know we need for, the practice of pediatric obesity? And that is tough sometimes when you have a growing child to do it, over a screen. But it, on the other hand, there are patients that, when you have a mixed hybrid model, like I see patients from 3 hours away, it's not realistic to have them drive here for every visit. But maybe I can see them once every 3 to 6 months, and the in between times we can do telemedicine. It really does help. And I also think, it extends our reach into that young adult age group, because the kids at 18, they go off, they go to college, they go far away for most of the year, and yet they're on medications. We want them to stay on medications. It's very difficult to transfer care for young adults to anybody. I don't know. I've had a lot of difficulty doing that, especially if they're in a college environment. And also, these are patients that, you know, you may have seen for years at this point. And it just makes sense to continue to see them. So I think that, you know, telemedicine, we're just sort of, I think, getting to the point where we're understanding how to use it better for chronic illness, you know?
Right. And I think there's some definitely good data that those kids who did have chronic disease, for example, who were able to connect to their chronic care management team, like you're talking about, Suzanne, those kids did better. Whether it's their diabetes or other complicated health management for some of these patients, kept them out of the ER, kept them, you know, out of the hospitals. And it can be cost saving. It can be green. There's a lot of pluses. And I think when you were in terms of monitoring those metrics, height, weight, kids are growing, there's more and more tools that we can be using. We can remember to leverage the medical home, their primary care doc, their school nurses to get the data shared with us through our portals. There's so many creative ways. We are working on an app where you can actually start to calculate body composition. So what the future holds for us, that flexibility that you're talking about, it allows patients to engage. And if you're sick or your patient's sick, they can still flip it to a Zoom and we can still see them. So I think how we use it, we have to use it wisely. We have to be judicious. And if there's concerns, then we absolutely want them to connect with us in person or their PCP, what have you, if they're really far away. But to remember that that just definitely can decrease those inequities that persist.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then the last thing we wanted to talk about today was updates on pharmacotherapy. Of course, everybody's always interested in this topic.
This is certainly growth in development, for sure. This year has been super exciting. We just noted that we were able to add into the new algorithm the most recent data that came out in publication and receiving FDA approval for setmelanotide, which is a medication for an MC4R agonist that we use for certain types of genetic obesity. Very small number, rare diagnoses, but very effective. And this has been studied down to age 2. So it previously had approval for 6 and older, and now we show that it can be equally as effective for these genetic forms of obesity for kids as young as 2. So going back to your conversation about the young child, being able to use these medications is super important. The other study that was published in late November and into December was the Scale Kids study that looked at children from 6 to under 11 for liraglutide, which was previously approved as Saxenda for adolescents. But now we saw safety and efficacy in that younger age range, almost a -8% change from placebo in BMI. This is incredible data that we can now share with our families, help them to feel more comfortable that we are doing due diligence. We want to be safe, but we now have some data to really help support that conversation and with our colleagues and hopefully expanding their ability to feel comfortable prescribing medications.
Okay. And then there are some trials in process right now. And so those ones are, there are two of them that are due to report out to close, the trial to close, and then the study results to be reported out this year. Do you want to discuss those?
So sure. So the Step Young trial is looking at semaglutide in the younger age range. We had Step Teens, which was what allowed our semaglutide for adolescents that you talked about that is now 2 years in terms of improving treatment options. So this is looking again at that younger age range from 6 to 11. So I think that'll be super exciting to expand, much like the Scale Kids will have now more than one GLP-1 agonist to add to our toolkit. And then also tirzepatide has simultaneously running for younger kids from 6 to 11 and then 12 to 17 for the use of obesity, as well as one for kids 10 to 18 for type 2 diabetes. So I think you're right. This will be a little bit of time before we get FDA approval. But again, it'll improve our toolkit for our patients and hopefully our colleagues.
I think the diabetes trial reports out a little bit later, but which is interesting because usually
we get
diabetes kids, the diabetes data first, but it's sort of, they're doing it sort of in reverse, which I love, but because if you have obesity and diabetes, you can use it. But if you have diabetes and, you know, if you just have diabetes, you can't, you know, we get caught in that conundrum with the kids who have diabetes and are obese, but because they have diabetes, we can't use certain medications. So I think this is all heading in the right direction. So I think we have hit on the highlights for the new pediatric algorithm. And as our listeners may or may not know, we are doing this annually because there's so much happening. And because the updates are, we're trying to keep the updates succinct, but also timely, because if we were doing it every 2 years and we were just having trouble keeping up with the volume of change. So now on the annual basis, we're providing, I think, more timely updates. And I hope that you all feel the same excitement that we do about what is happening in this field, because at least I think, and I know that Rui and Val think, that the future is bright and our kids certainly deserve it. So I'd really like to thank both Dr. O'Hara and Dr. Carufa for participating in this podcast, and like to thank the Obesity Medical Association for giving us this opportunity.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Obesity, a Disease. For more information about obesity medicine podcasts and other valuable resources from the clinical leaders in obesity medicine, please visit www.obesitymedicine.org/podcasts. If you enjoyed this episode and want to listen regularly, head over to iTunes, where you can subscribe, rate, and leave us a much appreciated review. The views expressed in this episode are those of the host and guest and do not necessarily represent the opinions, beliefs, or policies of the Obesity Medicine Association or its members. Please join us again for our next episode of Obesity, a Disease.